studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Mick Wall is my guest this week, and he is a renowned critic and rock and roll historian and has been involved in the music industry as well. And his books include the classic Paranoid, Black Days with Sabbath, and other horror stories. And his latest is the monumental When Giants Walked the Earth, a biography of Led Zeppelin. Mick Wall, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's a huge pleasure to be here, Gary.
Well, thank you. I know your book is, you wrote it a while ago. I think it was published last year over there, but we're just getting it over here. So.
Sure.
You know, I think, this is what I was thinking about when I was reading. Bing Crosby and Elvis Presley were both obviously, you know, huge influences on American popular music, and both were very eclectic in the music that informed their recordings and performances. With Bing Crosby, he combined pop with jazz and Western swing, Irish music, Hawaiian music, Mexican music. And Elvis sort of took all of what Bing Crosby had, and he put in Hank Williams and blues and rhythm and blues and gospel. Now, in your new book, When Giants Walk the Earth, you argue that Jimmy Page brought a sort of similar eclecticism to his band.
Yeah, and I think it's the reason why Led Zeppelin's music has become so timeless, considering how long ago their best recordings were made. You play them today, and they still sound as if they come from the future in many ways, and comparable artists from that time, and I include in this Hendrix, Cream, The Who, great though their recordings were, they clearly were made at a particular time in rock history. I think Jimmy's broad interest in music, what he calls his CIA, his Celtic, Indian and Asian influences, combined with traditional English folk music, a love of American blues. He really has a very, very broad spectrum of influences, classical music also, jazz. And all of that, I think, combined to make the sound of Led Zeppelin very full spectrum, very colorful. And also, when you consider that before he'd even formed the group, he'd already spent 5 or 6 years as one of the busiest session guitarists in the British music business. I mean, between one thing that astounded me during the courses of my research was the weird fact that between 63 and 68, Jimmy had played on something like 60% of every British manufactured homegrown hit that appeared in our charts. And that was everything from, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck and James Bond themes to Donovan, The Stones, The Who, The Kinks. He really had played with an enormous amount of different people. And again, I think all of these things gave him the broadest possible palette when it came to mixing up the colors and creating Led Zeppelin. And it very much was his creation. He picked everybody in the group. He produced the records. It was very much his vision, always.
What are some of the hidden lead guitar riffs that we think of that we don't know are Jimmy Page? Is there any you can think of? Oh, you probably don't know that that's Jimmy Page playing that on Season of the Witch. Is that one of his?
Yes. Excuse me, Gary. Yes, it is. Some of these artists, I don't know how well known they might be in America, but for instance, we have a very old crooner in this country called Val Dunican, an Irish singer who was enormous in the 60s, had his own TV show, a little bit of a Bing Crosby kind of character, and his most famous song, Walk Tall. Almost everybody in this country knows that song. What they don't know is that Jimmy's the guy playing the guitar on it. Goldfinger. The theme tune to Goldfinger.
The Shirley Bassey, is that who it is?
Yeah. Shirley Bassey, mm-hmm. John Barry's song. Big Jim Sullivan is the guy who actually plays the lead on it, and that's Jimmy playing the rhythm. He once told me a great story about how Shirley Bassey, when she recorded the song, came into the studio in a fur coat and threw it on the floor before her take, and then at the end of her take, fainted. You know, it's fantastic. he was a very young man. He was, I think, probably only 22 or 23 when he played on that. Of course, he played on, you know, Them, Van Morrison's group. He played on those records. He played on Easy Listening records. He played on classical records. The extraordinary thing for me, actually, considering how many sessions he did, he would sometimes do two or three a day, 5 or 6 days a week, was that he couldn't read music. You know, he never learned to read music. He did it all by ear. In fact, in his very earliest sessions, when he really was just 19 or 20, sometimes, because he couldn't read the music, he would turn his amp down so that, in fact, he didn't play on the session at all, which just shows you what a very wily character he was, even as a very young man. The other thing to mention, I think, is that all this session work, you know, brought him a considerable amount of money, so that joining the Yardbirds, as he did in 1966, was actually a step down for him financially. He was very much doing them a favor, if you like. And by the time, you know, he forms Led Zeppelin 2 years later, he already has a substantial property on the River Thames in a very small but extremely well-heeled village in Berkshire, England, called Pangbourne. It's not far from where I live now, in fact, and you have to imagine, not a gated community, but very similar in so much as every house has its own boat. It's right on the river. It's a very lush spot to live. And Jimmy was able to afford to buy a house there when he was just 24.
Well, you know, all these tracks that we were just talking about, that he was the session man on, and right up through the Yardbirds tracks, are pretty much all, you know, your typical kind of 3 minute single or 2.5 minutes. And the thing that's so striking about Led Zeppelin's music is the unusual song structure. I mean, there had been this era in which there were long jams and long tracks, you know, by Cream and other groups. But Led Zeppelin, they didn't just play for a long time, but they had these, it was like little movements within a song.
Well, that, I mean, one thing Jimmy told me was that the whole point of Led Zeppelin, as far as he was concerned, was it was like escaping prison and finding freedom. The years of doing sessions, playing on somebody else's dime, playing to a studio clock, at a time in the music business when album-oriented artists, I don't think there was even a phrase as album-oriented artist. It was very much here today, gone later today. You had to make hit songs, and they had to be played on the radio, and they had to go in the charts. People were releasing two or three albums a year. They were releasing 6, 7, 8 singles a year. It was a very high turnover, high-pressure situation. And that didn't alter with the Yardbirds. Although the Yardbirds were a very influential group that made many interesting album tracks, they were never considered in their own country, or even by their own management and record company, as an album-oriented act. It was very much about your hit songs. And this was extremely frustrating for Jimmy. He already had ideas above his station, if you like, as far back as 65, 66, when in fact he was already talking about perhaps forming his own group. He was talking about having Keith Moon on drums, Steve Marriott of the Small Faces, and then later Humble Pie on vocals. He already had a vision for where he wanted to go with rock music, and he was hoping to take the Yardbirds into that direction. But of course, as the newest member in what was, for the 60s, a very old act. I mean, they'd been around, by the time they split, finally in 68, they'd been around for 5 years. That was a very long time in the music business in the 1960s. They themselves, the other members, had no great expectations for what they might do next or where they would go. As far as they were concerned, they had done it. They had taken it as far as one could. Jimmy seeing what was going on with the Beatles, who he always still has a bit of a chip on his shoulder about, seeing where the Stones were starting to, the directions they were going in, and having played on sessions for them and helped them out in their early days, he's seeing, and of course the interest and success that Jeff Beck had after he left the Yardbirds, Jimmy is seeing people that he considers not even as good as him finding expression and success and interesting careers in areas that he has already wanted to go in but has never been able to. So one of the great joys for him in forming Led Zeppelin was, as he told me, it was never going to be about the studio clock again. It was never even going to be about holding a steady time or beat again. As he said, we wanted the music to find its own rhythm. If a song started to speed up or slow down, it's okay. Go with it. Let it. The music is finding its own best medium for expression. And so Zeppelin became this entity, as far as Page was concerned, that absolutely wasn't about hit songs. He'd played on dozens of hit songs. It was about albums. It was about live performance, very much in the sense that the jazz greats of the 50s and early 60s knew live performance. Spontaneity, improvisational aspects. Jimmy always characterized Led Zeppelin to me as a coming together of four elements to create what he called a fifth element, which was, in his words, this great monster. And he and John Paul Jones tell me that there was a telepathy that existed between the players, that different nights would bring about extraordinary moments where they themselves weren't always entirely in control of what was going on. It was happening because these four key elements had been mixed together and the fifth element was now taking over.
We're chatting with Mick Wall, and his new book is a biography of Led Zeppelin, When Giants Walk the Earth. Now, Mick Wall, you're a historian of music, but particularly heavy metal music. I know is one of your fields, and some say that the genre began with Cream, and some say Led Zeppelin, but is either group, you know, really heavy metal? What's your take on that?
I don't think either Cream or Led Zeppelin would be considered heavy metal. In the way that we understand the definition of heavy metal these days, or even from the 1980s onwards when the whole field of popular music became very niche-oriented. When I was a kid growing up with Cream and Led Zeppelin, I would also be listening to Bob Dylan, Sly Stone, David Bowie, Jim Croce, Miles Davis, Santana. There wasn't really, I don't think. There was a field known over here somewhat as heavy rock, and you'd have Led Zeppelin, you'd have Uriah Heep, Deep Purple. In America, of course, you know, it would stretch out to Aerosmith, Grand Funk, groups like that. But essentially, the whole idea really was there was good stuff and there was bad stuff. I think aspects of what Zeppelin did, clearly, you look at Whole Lot of Love, you look at Rock and Roll, clearly aspects of what they did and the riffs they came up with have inspired successive generations of rock artists to focus very much on that aspect of Zeppelin's sound and turn it into a genre. I mean, Black Sabbath, who most heavy metal, most modern contemporary metal artists would cite as the kind of forefathers of modern heavy metal, the kind of starting point for that detuned guitar sound. They themselves, who I worked with for many years, told me that when they were making their first and second albums, they used to lie around in the recording studio, stoned, listening to the first Led Zeppelin album. Geezer Butler told me that Paranoid, Sabbath's most famous tune of all, one of the most famous heavy metal songs of all time, was basically communication breakdown altered very, very slightly. In fact, Geezer was so appalled when Tony Iommi, the Sabbath guitarist, came up with Paranoid, because to him it was so obviously communication breakdown by Zeppelin, that he refused to play it and thought they should never do the song. And as he said, guess who was wrong? So definitely aspects of Zeppelin clearly inspired a whole strand of popular music, which we now know as heavy metal. But what makes Zeppelin so great and so interesting is the fact that that was really was just one string to their bow.
Oh, there's folk music is really equally strong, would you say?
Absolutely. Jimmy's interest in folk music was deep, remains deep. He was also the first. His interest in people like Bert Jansch, Davy Graham, John Renborn were huge influences on his own acoustic guitar style. And you can trace the thread from traditional folk songs like She Moved Through the Fair up to White Summer, which was his guitar showcase in the Yardbirds, into Black Mountain Side, which was essentially just a rewrite of Jansch's Blackwater Side, right up to Stairway to Heaven, which contains elements of She Moved Through the Fair, but clearly takes it a generation or two onwards into this cathedral-like, monumental rock, what's now considered, you know, one of the all-time great rock anthems. I think also you can't ignore the Oriental and Asian influence as well. I mean, Jimmy was the first rock musician in Britain, in England, to own a sitar. This was a long time before George Harrison owned a sitar. And those are very difficult instruments to learn to play, even for a very accomplished guitarist. And Jimmy went to Ravi Shankar, again, long before Ravi had been popularized in the Western world by George Harrison. Jimmy was going to Ravi Shankar concerts, small intimate settings in London, and going back afterwards and talking to Ravi about the sitar, about Indian scales, Indian classical music. And all of these things brought a bearing on some of the most extraordinary things that Zeppelin did musically.
Well, let me ask you about your book, When Giants Walk the Earth. The style you use, pretty consistently throughout the book, you kind of jump in and put the reader, you know, in the shoes or the heads of our heroes. You know, how did you arrive at that approach for this book?
There were two reasons for what I call the flashback sections. The first was a very pragmatic reason. I myself, you know, all writers are actually much greater readers than they are writers, you know, in the same sense that most musicians spend longer listening to music than they do playing it. And, of course, I've read a zillion biographies and have many favorites, but one terrible habit I've developed over the years is I tend to skip the beginning quite often to get on to the real meat of the story. And it's a big mistake because the motivations, the reason why, and there's no more important question you can ask than why. The answers to a lot of those questions are in the childhoods, the origins, the seeds of the story. But I'm a terrible skipper. I do tend to skip and try and get on to the sexy stuff. And so what I thought with this book I would do is just plant you straight in the middle of something exciting so that as you open the book, you are suddenly in a very good place with this story where it's all happening. Stuff is going on. You can infer things from the opening. I'm assuming that most people that buy the book already have a fairly developed idea of who Led Zeppelin were. And even if they don't, this is going to make you hold on to the book and not put it down. So we begin with a flashback, a Jimmy Page flashback, which goes right to the summer when he decided he would turn the Yardbirds into his own vehicle. The other reason I did it, and that theme continues through the book, so as you get into the action, occasionally you'll flash back to Plant's child, all of their childhoods, taking them right up to the moment when they finally form Led Zeppelin. The other main reason for it, and I think the reason why I in the end stuck with it throughout the book, is because I come from England. I've known Jimmy and Robert for over 20 years. I don't know John Paul as well, although we have obviously met and I've interviewed him over the years. I had met John Bonham on occasions when I worked for Black Sabbath many years ago, and I subsequently became good friends with Jason, his son. I got to know Richard Cole through my work with Sharon Osbourne and Don Arden. I got to know Peter Grant very well before he died. In fact, sadly, the year he died, we had just signed off on a contract for me to write Peter's official biography. So my involvement and interest with Zeppelin goes back a very, very long way. I also come from the same land they come from, and I feel I know those interiors reasonably well. I know those voices. And I feel that it's sometimes a disappointment with biographies that, I'm the same. I see a great film or read a great book. One imagines that the person that made that movie or wrote that book must in some way be a genius, must in some way live in a slightly different world to the rest of us. And in fact, the reality is they don't. They live in exactly the same world. Sometimes their motivations are very noble. Often the reasons why they do things are incredibly base. They're done for greedy reasons, for vain reasons, for stupid reasons, for unfair, weak reasons. And so I wanted to somehow show that these were real people that did real things for better or worse, and that were we in their shoes, we may well have done the very same things. And so the best way I could put you in those shoes, I felt, was to develop this device that allowed me not to just be third person, but to kind of get you in there as close to a first person, I did this, I did that, as possible. They're characterized as fictionalized, which is what they are, but they are based on extremely solid research. There's nothing really invented. Any quotes or words that they speak in those sections are actual quotes that come from actual sources, which are listed elsewhere in the book. So they're not just plain fantasies that have come out of my mind. They're based extensively on factual research. But I'm extrapolating, and I'm trying to put you with Peter Grant when he was taken from his... He never knew his father. And when he was taken from his mother, who was very doting and overbearing and a huge influence on the man he later became, I'm putting you in that room with him when he was young, when he was taken away from her in the Second World War because London was being bombed, as so many children were. I'm taking you and putting him into the wrestling ring where he worked sometimes for cash in the 50s, or when he worked as a strong-arm man for a ghetto landlord in London who was notorious for being a gangster. I'm putting you there when he worked with Don Arden on The Animals and Little Richard and Gene Vincent. I'm trying to say that Peter Grant didn't just arrive on this earth the day he decided to manage Led Zeppelin, or the day he had somebody thrown out of a building, or whatever it might be that Peter now has his reputation based on. There was a child that grew into a man, and there was a reason he became as he did. There was a reason he was such a father figure to Led Zeppelin, because he himself had no father. He himself craved that kind of love and attention. And so I try and do that with all the four members of the group, plus Peter, in order to give a far more rounded portrayal of the story of Led Zeppelin.
Well, you do make a point of saying that the book is an unauthorized biography, but on the other hand, you've talked to all of them. Have you gotten any feedback from any of them? Have they read the book? Do they dislike the book, like the book? What do you know about it?
Robert Plant's office, who I've got a lot of, I've been friends with all these people for many years, all of them declined to be directly involved in the book. And I was happy about that, in so much as when you become involved in the telling of an artist's story and their fingerprints are all over it, you have to be polite. You have to say please and thank you. You have to go easy on them. It's just a fact of life. When they do not have any control over the material, it leaves you free, if you're strong, to say, say what's really on your mind, to say what you feel is as close to the truth as you have been able to get. So that was good. Although, having said that, the reason the book came about was because I'd spent a great many years trying to persuade Jimmy to do his own book. 5 years ago, we came very close to doing something with Jimmy which would allow him to write his own book. Bob Dylan's Chronicles book had come out, and I tried to show Jimmy that here was a wonderful example of an artist who people were just delighted to read a book about that he had written, but actually didn't tell you anything about the aspects of his life that Dylan didn't want to go to and talk about, because there are many things in Jimmy's life he is loath to discuss. He doesn't want to talk about the drugs, he doesn't want to talk about the groupies, he doesn't want to talk about his interest, his very serious interest in the occult. And I tried to say to Jimmy, well, you don't have to do any of that. Talk to us about the music. Talk to us about how you arrived at this place in your life. Or let's just take a few key moments. And he came very, very close, but backed away big time when push came to shove. And that was his decision. Of course, that's totally fair. But that process took a couple years. And at the end of it, my whole point to him was that the only book out there that anybody knows about Led Zeppelin is Hammer of the Gods. And it really, you know, is that it? That's your legacy, is one book, Hammer of the Gods, and not even a very good book by contemporary standards, a kind of a tabloid expose type of book which came out a quarter of a century ago now and was good for its time and really good fun and well written, but actually is a kind of a cartoon. If it was a movie, it would be like The Evil Dead, you know, and I wanted to bring Citizen Kane to this story so that you don't shy away from the hard stuff, but you actually put it into a much greater context. And he just wasn't buying it. So I'd reached a stage in my own life and as a writer where I just felt this story had to be told, and that if I didn't do it, somebody else would come along and not do as good a job as I felt I could do. And so I took the plunge, and I let him know what I was doing, told him all about it, and to cut it short, he was okay about it for about the first year, and then around about the time they did the London show in 2007, suddenly all bets were off. He didn't even want me to be at that show. He sent a lawyer's letter to the publishers just a few weeks before the book was published in 2008. He did everything he could do to be obstructive. And because I'm very lucky and very fortunate to have a good, strong publisher, very experienced, if anything, it just made them more determined to get the book out. I did go to the London show. In fact, Jason Bonham got me a ticket, which he later got really told off about by Jimmy. Jimmy was not happy that Jason did that. But swing forward to just a few weeks before Christmas, this recent Christmas, 2009, and Jimmy and I are in the same room at an awards dinner in London, and I'm sitting on a table with Slash and Tony Iommi and Brian May, and at the next table is Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Joe Perry. So inevitably, we saw each other, and we spoke, and I'd love to tell you exactly what he said, but it was a private moment. He was very nice. He clearly has read every single word. I've been assured of that by mutual friends. Mm. And he whispered something to me which no one else could hear, and it was his main thought about the book. And it was, you know, it was a private thing, but he was telling me what he thought. And it was exactly what you might expect, because the book very much underlies the fact that, you know, Led Zeppelin was a dream Jimmy Page had that he turned into an incredible reality, but which subsequently over the last 30 years has, I think, turned into a kind of a nightmare for him. He would get Led Zeppelin back together today if only Robert Plant would agree to help him. And that's the crux of where we are right now with Led Zeppelin. Just as I was leaving this awards dinner, a radio station stopped me to do a quick interview. And as they were interviewing me, Jimmy Page happened to pass, and he leaned over my shoulder and said into the microphone, "I'm writing a book about Mick Wall." And then walked off. And then the London Times did a little interview, well, actually a very big interview with him just a couple of weeks ago, to help publicise the new movie, It Might Get Loud. And in typical fashion, all the journalist did was kind of ask him about my book, to the point where he really got under Jimmy's skin. And Jimmy repeated the line, "Well, actually, I'm writing a book about Mick Wall." So I think, I mean, the short answer is that, of course, he's not happy, because I try very hard to tell the truth. And the truth is a tough nut to crack. The truth of my life, of your life, I don't know necessarily if I would want someone to write that book for me either. But because Led Zeppelin had such an enormous impact around the world, because it's such a public issue, it's something we're discussing right now, you and I really did, at the end of the day, want the book to be something that would be a landmark and something that people could turn to try and find out the real story of Led Zeppelin. And it may not end. The book may have a different ending 2 years from now if things change between Jimmy and Robert. In fact, the U.S. edition has an 8,000-word updated chapter bringing you right up to the fall of 2009, which the original UK edition does not have. And of course, it's not a great ending. It's a tragedy, because Jimmy still wants Led Zeppelin. Jimmy, who hasn't released an album of original material for 13 years. Jimmy, who just turned 66 this month. Jimmy, who invented one of the greatest rock groups ever, still wants them to live. And Robert wants the whole thing to die. Well, and that's where we are.
You know, I mean, if you look at it from their points of view, I mean, in Robert Plant's case, and he won the Grammy Award for Album of the Year with his album Rising Sand with Alison Krauss. And it's a brilliant record. And he's continuously, all those years that you've been talking about Jimmy Page not putting out any album, I mean, Robert Plant has put out a handful of brilliant albums, and you know, his music is moving along. I mean, he doesn't want to be an oldies act. I mean, the impression I got from your book was that he was willing to sing Stairway to Heaven at the show, but he didn't want it to be the finale.
No, that's right. In fact, Robert had a number of conditions which he laid down before he agreed to do the 2007 show. Stairway to Heaven, which, you know, he's refused to sing for years. Clearly, they couldn't do a whole show and not play that song. It would have been too bizarre a statement to make. If you're going to do a show like that, do it with a good heart. He wanted it in the middle of the set. There was to be no big introduction to the song. There was to be no kind of posthumous remarks about it. It was just, we'll play it, we'll do it, and we'll move on to the next song. And that's exactly what happened. One of the other conditions was, Robert's very sensitive about being seen as a heavy metal artist in any way. So he wouldn't do Achilles' Last Stand because he felt it was too heavy metal. He insisted there was no improvisational aspect to the show. There would be no jamming. No wandering off musically into other universes and seeing where you ended up. There was to be no acoustic section. It was to be what he called a jukebox of their hits. And they started exactly at 9 o'clock and they ended exactly at 11 o'clock. And that's what it was, a jukebox of hits. And if that's what you want to see at a Led Zeppelin show, then they delivered beautifully. But of course, those of us that saw them in the 70s know that that wasn't what Led Zeppelin was about at all, and that wasn't why you went to see Led Zeppelin. You went to see the beast out of the cage, not stuck under a glass like a butterfly. And so Robert has laid down many, many conditions. The hugely sensitive spot for Robert, it's a number of things. It begins with the fact that he himself knows that when people look at the story of Zeppelin's music, if they are going to find a weakness, it will be in the vocals and the lyrics. A fantastic singer, not the greatest lyricist. At a time when you had Mick Jagger, Bob Dylan, David Bowie, John Lennon, you had, you know, some of the greatest lyricists in the history of rock at the height of their powers. Plant was coming out with some of the kind of hippy-trippy, Tolkien-esque, wishy-washy stuff that he was. Or he was simply recycling old folk and blues lyrics that he hadn't written in the first place. So it's a weak spot, and he's aware of it. Also, his image as the bare-chested, tight pants, the long curly hair, that's been imitated and turned into a parody, and he's very aware of that as well. But on a deeper level, there's a human aspect to this. Plant was a hired gun. He may not even have survived as far as the second album if he hadn't proved himself out on the road. Jimmy told me that. Robert knows that. He didn't even have a songwriting credit on the first Zeppelin album. There was every chance that he would have been replaced for the second, as people did in those days. You look at Beck, you look at Cream, people did that. But he survived that. Nevertheless, Jimmy was always in control. Peter Grant used to say, if the ship goes down, remember, it's Jimmy Page first, the others second. In the 30 years since Zeppelin split, the balance of power has shifted very much so that it's now Robert who's in control. And the reason it's Robert that's in control is because he does have a solo career. He isn't yearning to put Zeppelin back together. In fact, he yearns for the opposite. He yearns to be taken seriously as an artist in his own right. And finally, after 30 years with Alison Krauss, he's found that. I mean, you look at McCartney, you look at Jagger, even Townsend. You know, these are people that are still struggling to make new music that the rest of the world finds truly intriguing, not just based on reputation. Plant's got that suddenly with Alison Krauss, and he's not going to let it go. On a human level, there are other issues. When Plant's son, Carrick, tragically died in 1977 at the end of the most appalling stretch of shows on the American tour, their final American tour, where there were all kinds of terrible things going on behind the scenes. Page's heroin habit, Grant and Cole beating people up. Plant's son suddenly dies. And, you know, Jimmy didn't go to the funeral. Neither did John Paul Jones. And neither did Peter Grant. And, you know, stuff like that doesn't go away. Those memories don't fade over time. If anything, the bitterness grows deeper. And I think for very complicated reasons, and for all those reasons and others, Plant is not about to come running when Jimmy calls.
Well, it's a fascinating book and very well done, and it's called When Giants Walk the Earth, A Biography of Led Zeppelin, and the author is Mick Wall. And thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's been a huge pleasure, Gary. Thank you very much for having me on.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back again next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, the sparkling Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.